This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
So we're here at the end of the Trial Lawyers University Conference and been recording all week. Robert's been out here from Law Pods producing all of our shows, flew out here with the equipment. We thank you so much for doing that. It's been great recording live and I just really appreciate it.
No, fellas, I can't tell you what an absolute pleasure it's been to come here and do this for you. We've been working together for a while on your show. We've had some conversations over Zoom, but this is the first time to see you both in person, and it was every bit as good as I hoped it would be. So thanks so much for letting me be involved in your podcast, and this kind of lets me live my dream too. So thanks.
No, you were fantastic, and you know what? Everything is fully professional. You've been amazing to work with, and you do such a great job. So In addition to being a good person, so thank you.
Thanks so much.
And a recovering lawyer.
Yeah, I did my time.
Thanks. Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, live from the PSBR Trial College. How's it been going?
It's nice. Just really enjoyed the cross-examination seminar with your boss or colleague, Brian Panish.
I guess he's my boss.
I guess he's your colleague or your colleague now that you're a named partner. Or maybe he works for you. But that was really fun because they were doing clips and Roger Dodd and Trish Kundig were providing feedback. And it was an interesting thing to watch.
And you've got Roger Dodd coming to Maine to teach you and others.
He's coming. We're going to do the seminar for my whole law firm, and everybody there is going to go through it. And we're going to bring some other folks in to do it as well. So yeah, we're really excited about that. I could only get him to come because I promised to set him up on a duck hunt. So hopefully my friend will come through and find him some ducks to shoot while he's in town.
That's funny. Hopefully nobody in your office are sitting ducks during this cross-exam class, though.
I think Roger subscribes to the tough love approach to teaching. I know you went through his seminar. Is that the case?
Yes. So he cuts to the chase a little bit, but he always gives a little bit of positive feedback before he breaks you down.
But you can tell it's disingenuous, just a lead into the critique that's coming next.
100%. The nicer he is before he comments, the more afraid I am. So, because then the beatdown's just going to be that much harder. So,
well, we're really thrilled to have John Romano join us on the podcast. John is a well-known trial lawyer, sort of a hero of mine. I've known about you for years, although I just met you for the first time today. And he's practices out of West Palm Beach, Florida. So welcome, John.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. And it's interesting, you're just talking about Roger Dodd. And what is so wonderful about him, he's not only a just sensational courtroom advocate, he is a great teacher. And he is a mentor to literally not just hundreds, but thousands of lawyers. But when he teaches, you sit there, you're taking notes, you're listening. And the way he teaches, you can take it back to your firm Monday morning and insert what you learned into your cases, in depositions, in hearings, in mediation, in trial. And so it's just always wonderful to see him. And I had a chance to see him a little bit yesterday and then some today in his speaking. And once again, it was a great learning experience.
I just, before we went on live here, we were talking a little bit about Florida, and I'm really interested in, there's a whole lore that kind of, this Florida is steeped in when it comes to trial lawyers. And you said you moved there, what was it, 1950?
1954. I tell most people we moved from Boston, but actually I was born and raised initially in Framingham, Massachusetts, which is right outside of Boston.
So were you already practicing, or did you start your practice when you moved there, or were you still?
No, I was a little kid. I was 5 years old. My mom and dad moved the whole family, six kids. We moved down to the West Palm Beach area, and then I went through grade school, high school there, up to Florida State as an undergrad, then on to law school, then 3 years in the Marine Corps, and then back to practice in West Palm Beach.
And were you doing plaintiff's law from the outset? Or?
Well, when I was in the Marine Corps, after basically you have boot camp, every Marine, then you go 6 months of advanced infantry training, then to the JAG school, the Navy JAG school in Newport, Rhode Island. Then from there, your regular Marine and JAG, I was did both criminal defense and prosecution, mostly prosecution. And I did that for the remainder of my time in the Marine Corps. Then when I left and went back down to West Palm Beach, I was so fortunate, blessed, lucky, whatever you want to call it, because I landed a job with a firm called Cohn, Wagner, and Nugent. Al Cohn had been a former president of ATLA. Ward Wagner was about to be president of ATLA. And the firm was entrenched in the trial lawyer associations nationally and statewide. So I go to work for them. And of course, that was a great plaintiff's firm, and have been a plaintiff lawyer ever since. And trying and mediating and settling and handling cases and the works.
Just one more question about that era. What was that? I kind of think of that as sort of the heyday, or the peak of sort of all these lines of the trial bar that came out of Florida. And a lot of the great trial culture in our country seemed to have kind of emanated from Florida or the Deep South, but also Florida. What was going on in those days in Florida? It seemed like kind of a special place for trial lawyers.
It's funny you mention that, because when I came out of law school, the program that I was in, I was able to clerk for a law firm for my final semester. And I clerked for that Cohn, Wagner, Nugent firm, although I still had to go on active duty after that. So I knew when I was on active duty, I had a job with them because they'd offered me the job before I went with the Marine Corps. When I'm clerking for them, Al Cohn comes into the library one day when I'm working. I'd only been there a few days. And he said, "Johnny, what are you doing tomorrow?" Well, of course, the truthful answer is, whatever you want me to do. And so he took me and a few others. We flew over to Tampa, and that was my first seminar. So I'm a third-year law student, basically, in a clerkship program. And the very first speaker was Al Cohn. The second speaker was Melvin Belli. The third speaker, F. Lee Bailey, the famed criminal defense lawyer. Then Bill Colson from Miami. Then J.B. Spence. I sat there. I was physically so excited. I can't tell you how I felt. It was one giant after another. And they were saying, here's how to give an opening statement. Here's how to examine witnesses. And I remember thinking at that moment, I know exactly what I want to do forever. I want to be involved in courtroom cases. I actually, over the years, have done both civil and criminal. But Florida was loaded with those giants. And if you go back to the early days of ATLA, now AAJ, Melvin Belli was one of the founders. Bill Colson and Al Cohn were in that initial group in the 50s and 60s. And there was a lawyer from Tampa named Ed Rude. A lot of people don't know about him nowadays, but Ed Rude teamed up with Melvin Belli, Cohn, and others, and they formed what was called Rude's Raiders. And in the late 40s and in the 1950s, they started going around the country doing seminars in different regions and introducing such things as demonstrative evidence, which most lawyers didn't use up till that time. And so it was an extraordinary time. And the verdicts were also extraordinary. Let me give you an example. Wrongful death verdicts of, you're going to faint when I tell you this, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, and everybody was cheering. And it was not until really, I would say, around the mid-70s when the million-dollar verdict started to hit. And then there was one, and then there was two, and then there were several more, and it just took off. And ATLA began to swell with membership. And the 70s and 80s was explosively wonderful for the plaintiff's bar in its growth. And I'm thrilled that I get to be right in the middle of watching that happen. But as I've seen it evolve, it's just as explosively wonderful now. It's just that you got to understand it evolves. And there are paradigm shifts that occur. And the lawyers that keep going are successful, like a Roger Dodd. They adapt, they adjust, they know what moves to make, because you can't be a 1975 lawyer and practice today like a 1975 lawyer. Otherwise, you'll be eaten up.
So about that evolution over time, what are some of the things in the just the general practice of being a trial lawyer that have evolved in a way where you found it to be a negative evolution?
The negativity that I've seen in the practice of law has only been with those people who not only think in a negative way, but they have no vision. Okay? Over 100 years ago, a little girl went up to a very special lady. That lady happened to be Helen Keller, who, as we know, was deaf. She was blind and had disabilities. The little girl, in communicating to Helen Keller in her own special way, asked her, "Is there anything worse than losing your eyesight?" And Helen Keller, responding in her own special way, said, "Yes, losing your vision." The positivity in what we do as trial lawyers is about being a visionary. It's being able to close your eyes and see forever. That is what being a visionary is about. It's about this very program that we're at this weekend, Trial Lawyers University. It's a visionary program. Everybody is thinking to the next paradigm shift. Where are we going? What are we going to do? When I first started, we were told such things as, well, in jury selection, your main goal is establish rapport with the jury and get the jury to make promises. So you would say, "Do you all believe in presumption of innocence?" "Yes, we do." "Therefore, do you believe Jimmy, my client over here, to be innocent until the people sitting at that prosecution table prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt?" Everybody would say, "Yes." And then you sit down and you say, "I'm going to clap for myself. Wasn't that just a wonderful series of jury selection questions?" As we know, it was meaningless. Then poor Jimmy gets convicted because you didn't establish any challenges for cause. So as you fast forward today, the shift occurred. So now I might say something like this. Now that the prosecutor's done and you all have been sitting in the courtroom for a few hours, as you look over at Jimmy, who's been sitting next to me, may I see a showing of hands? Please feel free to put your hand up, of every one of you who are saying in your mind, "You know what? I bet he did something wrong, or he wouldn't be here in the first place. Let me see it." And all the hands go up. It doesn't mean they're bad jurors, but you know that's what they're thinking. So it's a totally different approach to everything. Opening statement, when I started, was really a short and plain statement, a little bit about the facts, a little bit about the issues, and then you sit down. Opening statement today, a good one, Okay. And assuming you have a good, open-minded judge who allows you to bring fairness and openness to the jury, it's a story that unfolds. And you get to lay out your case, as does the other side, which is wonderful. But that evolution of aspects in cases has become so important to what we do today.
In terms of the vision part of this, where do you see things going right now? What's the next big leap or step, do you think?
Well, number one, a lot of what we do and don't do depends on court decisions, legislative enactments. But what I have seen is, at least in my 48 years of practice, regardless of what courts have done, regardless what legislators have done, lawyers have developed ways, steps, to still, in a wonderful way, represent their clients and obtain great results for them. And that's what we are meant to do as lawyers, is develop ways that we can identify to do something wonderful for our client. That becomes such a key. The other thing that excites me to no end, let me back up just a minute. I hear a lot of people who are my age, okay, or people who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and you'll hear them say something about a particular age group. Well, the lawyers in that age group, and you know that we all have names for those different age groups. I'm not going to say it here, but they identify them and they say, well, they're not up to it, or they don't do this, or they spend too much time with their computers, and they don't talk, and they don't want to work. And that is nonsense. I remember my grandfather coming in on a Saturday morning. He popped in. We're all sitting around on the floor watching a TV show called Sky King in the 1950s. And he came in and started lecturing us on how we're like, he didn't use these words, but you know, you're destroying your lives. It's a Saturday. Why are you not out playing? You're sitting here. Okay, well, what are kids doing today? Some of them are out playing, but some are, they're on their computers. And nowadays you put on a headphone set and you can play with 20 kids all over the county. So the great news is the young lawyers, I think, are every bit as motivated. They have the emotional touch of what is necessary. They're equipped with the brains. They know technology. In my view, we're going to be in better hands with the lawyers that are being developed now than ever before. So what excites me when we talk about vision is they're up to it and they're going to be great. But they need lawyers like each of the two of you. They need lawyers like a Roger Dodd, a Brian Panish, so many others to be their mentors, because I don't care who you are, you need somebody to correct the course for you every once in a while when you might be going in a little wrong direction, and they need to bring you back on course. And we all need that. And usually, in my case, it's been my parents, my wife, brothers, sisters, later on my kids. We all help correct one another in the course that we're going, and that becomes such a key.
So in trial, I'm sure you probably enjoy all aspects of it, but is there a certain part of trial that's your favorite part?
By far and away, it's jury selection. And the reason is I feel as though that's what I was meant to do, chat with large groups of people. And there's such a challenge when you're trying to persuade them. One of the things I learned early on about jury selection that has helped me to this day, and I learned it from a judge who was critiquing us after a trial. When you're in jury selection, relax. Don't be all tensed up. And second, pretend when you're speaking to each juror as if you're speaking to a stranger in a park, just sit next to the stranger on a bench having a conversation. Avoid hypercorrect speech. Don't search for the perfect words. Just speak from your heart when you're talking to the jurors. And then they will feel the genuineness in you. There is a saying, authenticity is the first cousin of credibility. the jury starts to see that when they first see you. It might even be in the parking lot. But they really start to feel it during jury selection. So I love that. It's also the part of the trial I worry about the most, because I think that most of us as lawyers are prepared to the point where we know what's going to happen during the trial. We know what most witnesses are going to say. Sometimes there are little things that happen that we go, whoa, I didn't see that coming.
Right, right.
And I know somebody's going to say, well, a good lawyer is prepared for everything. Yeah, well, I don't care how good you are. Sometimes you get hit with the curveball in trial. And
what do you do when that happens? How do you handle that?
Well, you try not to let the curveball get by you. So when it's coming out of the pitcher's hand and you can see it's a curveball, you start immediately adjusting so you can smack it out of the park. And I know that's easy to say, okay, but you can't panic when you have a curveball. You just have to deal with it. And once in a while, a witness will say something that is an error. Sometimes an expert goes south on you. Sometimes opposing counsel will do something, and you know it's grounds for a mistrial, but the case is otherwise going really good. What do you do? Do you move for a mistrial or not move for a mistrial? And you're going with the flow to make your determinations. I was in a trial, it was probably about 10 years ago, and they were on their second day. This was a commercial business tort case. They were on their second day of cross-examining one of my clients. During the cross-examination, this guy kept going over the same thing. So finally, I stood up and I said, Your Honor, objection. I asked and answered. He goes, sustained. Counsel, move on. About a minute later, I jump up. Your Honor, objection. Asked and answered. He goes, counsel, I told you, move on. And he sustained my objection. So I wait a couple more minutes and I go, Your Honor, objection, ask and answer, redundant, repetitive. I said, and one more thing, Judge. This is a violation of our rights pursuant to the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution. This case was tried on court TV, by the way.
This is a criminal case, I take it.
No, a commercial business tort case. Yeah. And I said, a violation of the Eighth Amendment. And the judge immediately, he just burst out laughing. And the lawyer who was cross-examining our client was all upset. He didn't know what was happening. And everybody's looking all around. And so he says, up to the bench. Well, we get up to the bench and, you know, they turn the little white noise gadget on. He forgot to turn it on. So we're talking and everybody in the courtroom can hear us, and it's on camera. And the defense lawyer says, I don't understand what this is all about. And the judge looks over at me and says, do you want to tell him or shall I? And I said, no, Judge, I would rather Your Honor tell him. And he goes, counsel, he's looking right at this guy. He goes, Mr. Romano is suggesting that you are submitting all of us to cruel and unusual punishment. And everybody in the courtroom, including the jury, they all just bust out laughing. Now, the key is I was in my mid-60s when I did that. A head of white hair. I never could have gotten away with a comment like that if I was 30 or 35, because then I'm a wise guy kid, and so it all depends. There are certain things you can do. It depends on the case, the age, the judge, the circumstances, etc. But when you look up and you can tell that the judge and jury, they're all upset because this guy's plowing over the set. They're ready for some humor.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
So tell us about the breakout session that you had here at the Trial College.
Oh, my goodness. It was fun. We did it Thursday, a couple of days ago. We went actually for 4 hours, 8:30 to 12:30, and it was all on pain, suffering, anguish, loss of enjoyment of life, loss of consortium. So all, I know there's a lot more elements of non-economic damage, but we started to cover them. And we got through probably one third of what we needed to do. So I told the group, I said, I got some great news for you. We're going to finish this session remotely. So in about 3 or 4 weeks, we're going to have a 90-minute to 2-hour session. And then a month later again, and a month later again. And I don't care if we do it indefinitely. We're going to keep the group together. And they were excited about that. But we went into things like, here's an example. Pain differs vastly from suffering. Yet, 99% of lawyers in America just present it to the jury as pain and suffering. And they don't have anybody define the difference. Think about this. If either one of you were trying a med mal case and you failed to have a medical expert define what is meant by a breach of the standard of care, that would be legal malpractice. If either one of you, or me, trying a product liability case and we failed to have, say, an engineer define what is meant by product defect, that would be legal malpractice. Yet, in all of these cases tried around America, nobody provides the jury with a definition of pain. I often do it through the defense medical examiner. You got to be careful because that, again, depends on the circumstances. But in one trial about 3 years ago, they called the defense medical examiner as their first defense witness. I get up, my first question, define physical pain. He says, I'm not sure what you mean by that, counsel. I go, well, I'm going to repeat the question. Define physical pain. I don't understand the question. So I hold up his report and I said, this your name? You're with this group? Yep. And it says here, your specialty is pain medicine and rehabilitation. Yeah. I said, I just want you to assume that in your report, and the number happened to be 48, you use the word pain 48 times. Okay? Now what I want you to do is look at the folks on the jury and define pain. He says, very well. He ends up giving one of the greatest definitions I've ever heard. I said, do you agree pain differs vastly from suffering? He said, yes, it does. And do you agree that sometimes you can have an event occur which causes mental anguish? And that mental anguish begets physical pain, which begets physical suffering, et cetera. We went into a long discussion about it. But to me, it was important that we talked about that, about pain and suffering. We talked about how important it is for them to join the International Association for the Study of Pain, which has an entire series of definitions and standards dealing with pain. Just for example, one item they have is, as a part of the definition of pain, paraphrasing, every physician must respect every patient's complaint of pain. Well, you know these defense medical examiners don't do that. They just flip it away like using a fly swat to hit a fly. That's what they do with it. Well, the International Association for the Study of Pain says, if you're a doctor, you should respect every patient's complaint of pain. I want to ask them that in their deposition. So we talked about that in our session.
What did he say the definition of pain was? Do you have a memory of that or paraphrase? I'm just curious.
The answer is, he said it was pain is an unpleasant sensation. And what we had him do, I used an example with him because
you inflicted pain on him.
Well, here's the problem. The definition of pain, it would have meaning to you. Okay, it has meaning to me, but some people would hear that and it would just go, I don't even know what that means. So I said, let me give you an example, doctor. If I were to reach over and take an open safety pin and stick it into your arm, that immediate prickly sensation where you jerk back because you now feel it and it hurts, that's physical pain, right? He goes, that would be an example of physical pain. I said, okay. Now, in the minutes or perhaps hours later, when it starts to turn black and blue, and then it starts to throb because an infection's setting in, that would be suffering. He says, yes, that would be suffering. I said, but as I look at it and I worry, oh my God, I may have an infection that's going to go up my arm and cause a serious illness. That would be an example of mental anguish. And he said, yes. And that's what I was getting at when we were teaching the group the other day. The jury needs to understand the differences between these and the difference between mental anguish and mental pain, the difference between scarring and disfigurement. If there's a scar, there's always going to be disfigurement, but you can often be disfigured without a scar. Okay? Someone with severe cerebral palsy might be disfigured because of the way their arms and legs are curled up, spasticity. Yes, but they don't have any scars. So those are the kinds of things I wanted them to be thinking about. Separate these out so that when you think of the elements of damages, be thinking each element is an island unto itself, but islands connected to one another.
What is the implication of that, for instance, for the physiatrist's report where he uses the term pain 48 times, but probably saying that your client actually doesn't have any, or there's no evidence of that, right? That's usually what the defense IME doctor is saying. So if you distinguish between the pain, the suffering, the mental anguish, does that then allow you to do something when you're going forward with your questioning in terms of defeating some of their assumptions or conclusions about your client?
It does and it can, but I will tell you this. I am 100% on board with something Brian Panish said yesterday. And he commented, when he's cross-examining a doctor, he's not going to take the doctor head on medicine and anatomy. And I can tell you in my experience, John Romano has never out-orthopedic'd an orthopedic surgeon. I've never out-neurosurgeried a neurosurgeon. So I want to get early in the cross, at least the one that I'm talking about with that physiatrist, certain concessions while I've got them in a more friendly mode. And then I will go on the attack over issues of bias or things that he missed, records he didn't have, those sorts of things. But the whole idea, I think one of the most important things you bring out with the defense medical examiner is your exam has nothing to do with healing, with curing, with helping a patient get better. Your exam has to do with money and nothing else. And I like to make a big deal about that because the treaters, they're trying to get the person to feel better, to make the back pain go away, rehabilitate the brain or whatever it may be. The defense medical examiner, not at all.
So then with that sort of setup of separating out each of the elements of non-economic damages, do you build that into your closing argument through charts or other ways to say, here's the evidence of the physical pain and here's the amount that should be awarded for it?
Yes, all of the above, because I do like to go down the elements and give a specific suggested number for each element. So after we get by wages and meds, if the first one is physical pain and suffering, I like to write physical pain in the past, and then I'll put a number. And I always bring out a number during jury selection, always. And once in a while, I'll be somewhere where...
You mean a global number for the whole case?
Yeah. Example, in jury selection, I might be discussing something with a juror who is a caregiver for a loved one. And it's very emotional for them to talk about it. Well, while I'm talking to that juror, I may say, because we're talking about this, and I know this is very emotional for you, there's a very important question I need to ask you. And so that everyone knows, I'm going to ask this question of each and every one of you individually, because it's that important. But Mrs. Jenkins, at the close of the evidence, we may ask you for a verdict not to exceed $89 million. When you hear that number, are you saying in the back of your mind, I don't care what the evidence is, I will never go there. Not me, no way, not going to happen. How do you feel? And I'll get that juror talking about it. There will be some jurors who will say, no way would I ever go to 89. I say, fine, tell me your feelings. Why do you feel that way? And then I say, how many agree with Mr. Smith, who says he doesn't care what the evidence is, he'll never go there? Well, in Florida, they're gone for cause, and there's no rehabilitation. So, yeah, I mean, I want to go into the elements, but I give a number in the very beginning of the case.
Does that number, the $89 million, that would need to be a realistic number that you might actually ask for in the case, right? You can't just throw out the largest number you can come up with in order to disqualify jurors.
That is the number that we have thought out strategically. That is the number we want to ask them for in summation. That is an important question. We always try to do that. Every once in a while, I'll try a case in a jurisdiction where you can't throw out a specific number in voir dire. So we have to say, is there any number in your mind that you would not go beyond no matter what the evidence is? And a juror might, I mean, I've had them say, well, yeah, Mr. Romano, if you're looking for $100 million, I would never go there. I said, well,
we're only looking for 89, so we're good, right?
Yeah, well, I'd like to be able to say that. Yeah. But, and then sometimes when you're limited, either the judge limits you or the jurisdiction you might be in, you can't use a specific number. It's amazing. You start talking about other things, and the jurors on their own, they start talking about numbers. But it is important as early as possible to have the jurors begin to understand the significance of the dollars the plaintiff is seeking, just as it is important for the defense to let the jury know in a case where they're contesting liability, they're seeking zero. They're allowed to do that. Why shouldn't the plaintiff lawyer be allowed to explain to the jury what the plaintiff will be seeking? And we often get into that tug of war of an argument in front of the judge.
When you look back at your career and the cases you've tried, are there some that stand out to you even now as being particularly memorable or meaningful for you, or turning points in your career, whether it's criminal or civil trial?
I would say the answer is yes. I mean, I could probably think of 7 or 8 trials that are the ones that I think about the most. I can remember every case I've lost, by the way, and I often think of what went wrong, why it went wrong, et cetera. The first case I ever tried, which is the one we started talking about, was a very simple civil assault and battery case. That had great meaning because that was my first trial. I can almost go through all of the evidence in it right now because it meant so much to me. But I will tell you that I was in a... Sometimes things happen, and something happens in your life where things crystallize. And it happened to me in March. You asked the question. It happened in March of 2009. I was in federal court, Fort Myers, Florida, trying a trucking wrongful death case. Our case went very well. It was a case where the federal judge granted my motion for attorney voir dire, so I was able to ask questions of the jury for a couple of hours. Then the defense is finishing up its case and has a final witness. And their final witness is a life expectancy expert they brought from out of state. And on direct examination, he said there was evidence that the decedent, who was about 52 years old, had kidney problems and that was going to lead to renal failure, and therefore he was going to die within 5 years. So they were trying to tell the jury, even if you bring back a verdict, only give the family 5 years worth of damages. Now, I had a stack of depositions. I had an outline that we had been working on really for months because we knew how important this guy was to the defense. And all I can tell you is that just something came over me in this trial. And when I stood up, I didn't move from behind the table other than to stand up. I pushed aside the outline and the stack, turned to my left to look back over at the family I represented. The witnesses way off to my right. I'm not even looking at them. And I said to the witness while looking at the family, tell this widow and mother and tell these two daughters the date they would have been going to daddy's funeral. Give them a date. I don't hear anything. I wait. I look up at the judge. Your Honor, I'd ask the court to instruct the witness to answer the question. He says, answer the question. I don't understand the question. I basically restate the question while looking at the family. In almost a whisper, he says, I don't know. I can't give you a date. I said, I don't have anything else for this guy. And at that moment, that was my best cross-examination ever, because it was, I didn't go into anything with him about medicine, renal failure, what's in the records, nothing. Because by then, he's the final witness in a 3-week trial. The jury gets what's going on. And we got a wonderful verdict. They just spanked this trucking company. And so sometimes things happen when you're in trial and you just, you do things. And I still can't explain.
I mean, I don't know anything about your case, your trial, but I was almost moved to tears just by you telling me that.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's so powerful. And you just have to picture the scene there. And that's incredible. Well,
that's interesting when you say that, because creating word pictures in the minds of jurors is essential when you're a plaintiff's lawyer. And I learned that from Teddy Koskoff of the Koskoff firm out of Bridgeport, Connecticut, back when I went to the initial College of Advocacy program for ATLA. Shortly after that, I was getting ready to try a wrongful death case in Stuart, Florida, which is about 40 minutes north of West Palm Beach. It was a trucking case also. I called Teddy Koskoff and I told him about the case. And I said, you told us to create word pictures. I don't know how to do it for this case. And I've gone round and round with people at the firm. And all of a sudden, he gives me the following. And then I'll tell you what happened. Fast forward, now we're in trial in June of 1978. And the judge says, are you ready to begin your opening statement? And I was trying it with a partner in the firm, but he picked the jury. I gave the opening. I walk right up in front of the jury and start with this. We bring to you this morning the case of a young mom and dad standing on a hillside under a tree at the gravesite of their little girl. I got that from Teddy Koskoff. When the trial was over, one of the jurors comes up to us. She's crying because it was a very emotional case. And she is giving us and the family big hugs. And she says to me, I can't get that image out of my head. I said, what image? The image of family at a hillside, under a tree, at the graveside of the little girl. Word pictures are so powerful. If I ask either one of you right now, tell me about your high school graduation, there's an image that just popped into your minds of something from the graduation. And it might be getting your diploma, hugging a grandparent or your parents, maybe some kid up on the stage who mooned the crowd, but something. If I ask somebody about, tell me about your wedding day, boom, there's certain images that pop right to you. Okay, it's the same thing with jurors. When they go back to deliberate, they think of different images of the more powerful things that happened during the trial.
Oh, that's really, really powerful stuff. It got me thinking about my graduation and wedding day, too.
I know.
Oh.
Well, we really appreciate your time. This is our time flew by. We'd love to have you back again to continue the conversation.
I would love to do it. I would love to do it.
You're fantastic, and I just want to say your calm presence is probably something that you clearly carry into the courtroom, and that the jury must just like eat up, because it is so credible just in and of itself, just the way you present yourself. So thank you.
Well, this has been very enjoyable, and it's been really an honor working with each of you.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, John.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.